Hello and welcome to the Learning College. Today we're going to resume with Richard Harwood's Did 6 Million Really Die? And we'll pick up with point number 4. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Again, Richard Harwood's Did 6 Million Really Die? Point 4. The 6 million, colon, documentary evidence. The 6 million documentary evidence. From the foregoing, it would seem certain that the figure of 6 million murdered Jews amounts to nothing more than a vague compromise between several quite baseless estimates. There is not a shred of documentary evidence for it that is trustworthy. Not a shred of documentary evidence for the figure of 6 million that is trustworthy. Occasionally, writers narrow it down to give a disarming appearance of authenticity. Lord Russell of Liverpool, for example, in his The Scourge of the Swastika, London, 1954, claimed that, quote, not less than 5 million, unquote, Jews died in German concentration camps, having satisfied himself that he was somewhere between those who estimated 6 million and those who preferred 4 million. But, he admitted, quote, the real number will never be known. If so, it is difficult to know how he could have asserted, quote, not less than 5 million. The Joint Distribution Committee favors 5,012,000, but the Jewish, quote, expert Reitlinger suggests a novel figure of 4,192,200, quote, missing Jews, unquote, of whom an estimated one-third died of natural causes. This would reduce the number deliberately exterminated, quote, unquote, to 2,796,000. However, Dr. M. Perlzweig, the New York delegate to a World Jewish Congress press conference held at Geneva in 1948, stated, Dr. M. Perlzweig, Zweig means branch in German, Perl means pearl, pearl branch. Dr. M. Perlzweig, the New York delegate to a WJC press conference held in Geneva in 1948 stated, Dr. Perlzweig, quote, the price of the downfall of National Socialism and Fascism is the fact that 7 million Jews lost their lives thanks to cruel anti-Semitism. In the press and elsewhere, the figure is often casually lifted to 8 million or sometimes even 9 million. As we approved in the previous chapter, none of these figures are in the remotest degree plausible. Indeed, they are ridiculous. Fantastic exaggerations. So far as is known, the first accusation against the Germans of the mass murder of Jews in wartime Europe was made by the Polish Jew Raphael Lemkin, L-E-M-K-I-N, in his book Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, published in New York in 1943. So Raphael Lemkin, Axis Rule in Occupied Europe from New York, 1943, mid-war. Somewhat coincidentally, Lemkin was later to draw up the UN Genocide Convention, which seeks to outlaw racialism, quote-unquote, racialism in quotes. His book claimed that the Nazis had destroyed millions of Jews, perhaps as many as 6 million. This, by 1943, would have been remarkable indeed, since the action was allegedly started only in the summer of 1942. At such a rate, the entire world Jewish population would have been exterminated by 1945. After the war, propaganda estimates spiraled to heights even more fantastic. Kurt Gerstein, an anti-Nazi who claimed to have infiltrated the SS, told the French interrogator Raymond Cartier that he knew that no less than 40 million concentration camp internees had been gassed. So Kurt Gerstein tells French interrogator that 40 million were gassed. I guess Jews and non-Jews, since there weren't even 40 million, there weren't even half that many Jews in the entire world. In his first signed memorandum of April 26, 1945, he reduced the figure to 25 million, But even this was too bizarre for French intelligence. And in his second memorandum, signed at Rottweil on May 4, 1945, he brought the figure closer to the 6 million preferred at the Nuremberg trials. Gerstein's sister was congenitally insane and died by euthanasia, which may well suggest a streak of mental instability in Gerstein himself. He had, in fact, been convicted in 1936 of sending eccentric mail through the post. After his two, quote, confessions, unquote, he hanged himself at Cherche Midi prison in Paris. C-H-E-R-C-H-E, like Cherche, like search in French. Midi, M-I-D-I, two words. After two, quote-unquote, confessions, hanged himself at Cherche Midi prison in Paris. Gerstein alleged that during the war he passed on information concerning the murder of Jews to the Swedish government through a German baron, but for some inexplicable reason his report was, quote, filed away and forgotten. So this guy is clearly a fantasist. He also claimed that in August 1942 he informed the papal nuncio in Berlin, that's like a diplomatic delegate, the term is nuncio in Berlin, about the whole, quote, extermination program, but the reverend person merely told him to get out. The Gerstein statements abound with claims to have witnessed the most gigantic mass executions, 12,000 in a single day at Belzec, while the second memorandum describes a visit by Hitler to a concentration camp in Poland on June 6, 1942, which is known never to have taken place. So this guy is just pulling stuff out of his ass. Gerstein's fantastic exaggerations have done little but discredit the whole notion of mass extermination. Indeed, Evangelical Bishop Wilhelm Debellius of Berlin denounced his memoranda as, quote, untrustworthy. And that comes from H. Rothfels' Augenzeugenbericht, eyewitness report, zu den Massenvergassungen of the mass gassing in Vierteljahrshefte für Zeitgeschichte, April 1953, the quarterly yearbook for history. It is an incredible fact, however, that in spite of this denunciation, the German government in 1955 issued an edition of the second Gerstein memorandum for distribution in German schools. Dokumentation zur Massenvergassung, Bonn, 1955. Documentation of mass gassing, put out by Bonn. That would be that's the capital of West Germany after the war, is publishing that garbage in 1955 and putting it in schools. In it, they stated that Debellius, D-I-B-E-L-I-U-S, placed his special confidence in Gerstein and that his memoranda were, quote, valid beyond any doubt, direct quote. This is a striking example of the way in which the baseless charge of genocide by the Nazis is perpetuated in Germany and directed especially to the youth. So the German youth after World War II are probably the most propagandized people in history. The story of 6 million Jews exterminated during the war was given final authority at the Nuremberg trials by the statements of Dr. Wilhelm Hertel, H-O-E-T-T-E-L, so H-O with an umlaut, T-T-L, Wilhelm Hertel at the Nuremberg trials. He had been an assistant of Eichmann's, but was in fact a rather strange person in the service of American intelligence who had written several books under the pseudonym of Walter Hagen. Hertel also worked for Soviet espionage, collaborating with two Jewish emigrants from Vienna, Perger and Werber, who acted as U.S. officers during the preliminary inquiries of the Nuremberg trials. It is remarkable that the testimony of this highly dubious person, Hertel, is said to constitute the only, quote, proof regarding the murder of 6 million Jews. The only proof is from this Hertel fellow. In his affidavit of November 26, 1945, he stated, not that he knew, but that Eichmann had, quote, told him, unquote, in August 1944, in Budapest, that a total of 6 million Jews had been exterminated. Needless to say, Eichmann never corroborated this claim at his trial. Eichmann was forcibly abducted by Jews illegally from Argentina and taken to Israel and put on a show trial and closed in a glass box. And he did not corroborate that he had said that 6 million Jews had been exterminated, as this dubious fellow spying for both sides, Walter Hagen, fake name, had said, who was actually a guy named Hurdle. Hurdle was working as an American spy during the whole of the latter period of the war, and it is, therefore, very odd indeed that he never gave the slightest hint to the Americans of a policy to murder Jews, even though he worked directly under Heydrich and Eichmann. Absence of evidence. It should be emphasized straight away that there is not a single document in existence which proves that the Germans intended to, or carried out, the deliberate murder of Jews. In Poliakov and Wolff's Das Dritte Reich und die Juden, Dokumente und Aufsätze, Berlin, 1955, Poliakov and Wolff's The Third Reich and the Jews, Documents and Aufsätze, either briefs or legal papers, Berlin, 1955, the most they can assemble are statements extracted after the war from people like Hurdle, Ohlendorf, and Wislicenny. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. It's probably a Czech name. The latter under torture in a Soviet prison. In the absence of any evidence, therefore, Poliakov is forced to write, quote, the three or four people chiefly involved in drawing up the plan for total extermination are dead, and no documents survive. Direct quote from Poliakov, Poliakov. This seems very convenient. Quite obviously, both the plan and the, quote, three or four people are nothing but nebulous assumptions on the part of the writer and are entirely unprovable. The documents which do survive, of course, make no mention at all of extermination, so that writers like Poliakov and Reitlinger again make the convenient assumption that such orders were generally, quote, verbal. Though lacking any documentary proof, they assume that a plan to murder Jews must have originated in 1941, coinciding with the attack on Russia. Phase 1 of the plan is alleged to have involved the massacre of Soviet Jews, a claim we shall disprove later. The rest of the program is supposed to have begun in March 1942, with the deportation and concentration of European Jews in the eastern camps of the Polish government general, such as the giant industrial complex at Auschwitz near Krakow. The fantastic and quite groundless assumption throughout is that transportation to the east, supervised by Eichmann's department, actually meant immediate extermination in ovens on arrival. Think how wacky that is. You're going to transport all these people in the middle of a two-front war so you can stick these people in ovens somewhere. I mean, if you were going to kill a massive number of people, wouldn't you just simply shoot them and throw them in a pit? Shoot them and dump them in the woods or something. I mean, that's how you do it. As the Jew Soviets did at Katyn in Poland to Poles, and then blamed it on the Nazis. They're not content with blaming the Nazis for imaginary assassinations. They assassinate people themselves and then blame those on the Nazis too. How about that? And all this is circulated in the West with an ostensibly free press because the West is under the control of these same nasty mass murderers. According to Manvel and Frankel, Heinrich Himmler, London, 1965, the policy of genocide, quote, seems to have been arrived at, unquote, after, quote, secret discussions between Hitler and Himmler, page 118, though they failed to prove it. Reitlinger and Poliakov guess along similar, quote, verbal lines, adding that no one else was allowed to be present at these discussions, and no records were ever kept of them. Well, that's convenient. This is the purest invention, for there is not a shred of evidence that even suggests such outlandish meetings took place. William Shirer, in his generally wild and irresponsible book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, is similarly muted on the subject of documentary proof. He states weakly that Hitler's supposed order for the murder of Jews, quote, apparently was never committed to paper. At least no copy of it has yet been unearthed. It was probably given verbally to Goering, Himmler, and Heydrich, who passed it down, page 1148. A typical example of the kind of proof quoted in support of the extermination legend is given by Manvel and Frankel. They cite a memorandum of 31st July 1941, sent by Goering to Heydrich, who headed the Reich Security Head Office and was Himmler's deputy. Significantly, the memorandum begins, quote, "Supplementing the task that was assigned to you on 24th January 1939 to solve the Jewish problem by means of emigration and evacuation in the best possible way according to present conditions." Close quote. The supplementary task assigned to the memorandum is a total solution, Gesamtlösung, of the Jewish question within the area of German influence in Europe, close quote, which the authors admit means concentration in the East, and it requests preparations for the, quote, organizational, financial, and material matters, unquote, involved. So they have nothing obvious on paper, so they take stuff that means something else and they twist its meaning in order to justify their gross, grotesque blood libels against Germans. And then they will use those grotesque libels against Nazis to condemn all Germany and to condemn all white people. That's how Jews roll. The memorandum then requests a future plan for the, quote, desired final solution, Endlösung, which clearly refers to the ideal and ultimate scheme of emigration and evacuation mentioned at the beginning of the directive. No mention whatever is made of murdering people, but Manville and Frankel assure us that this is what the memorandum is really about. Again, of course, the, quote, true nature of the final, as distinct from the total solution, was made known to Heydrich by Göring verbally. So if you don't have any proof, you can twist words or you can simply make up meetings and make up things that people said that were never recorded. I mean, very convenient. It's just a bunch of lies. That's all it is. The convenience of these, quote, verbal directives issuing back and forth is obvious. The Wannsee Conference. The final details of the plan to exterminate Jews were supposed to have been made at a conference at Gross Wannsee in Berlin on 20th January 1942, presided over by Heydrich, Polyakov, Das Dritte Reich und die Juden, page 120 FF, Reitlinger and the Final Solution, page 95 FF. Officials of all German ministries were present, and Müller and Eichmann represented Gestapo head office. Reitlinger and Manville and Frankel consider the minutes of this conference to be their trump card in proving the existence of a genocide plan, but the truth is that no such plan was even mentioned, and what is more, they freely admit this. Manville and Frankel explain it away rather lamely by saying that, quote, the minutes are shrouded in the form of officialdom that cloaks the real significance of the words and terminology that are used. That's from The Incomparable Crime, London, 1967, page 46, which really means that they intend to interpret them in their own way. What Heydrich actually said was that, as in the memorandum quoted above, he had been commissioned by Göring to arrange a solution to the Jewish problem. Göring commissions Heydrich to solve the Jewish problem. No extermination implied. Emigration and evacuation are the means. He reviewed the history of Jewish emigration, stated that the war had rendered the Madagascar project impractical, and continued, quote, the emigration program has been replaced now by the evacuation of Jews to the East as a further possible solution in accordance with the previous authorization of the Führer, close quote. So from encouraging and helping Jews to emigrate from Germany, as most of them, the vast majority, did before the war, and also from Austria and Czechoslovakia, now they have moved during the war to evacuating them to the East, putting them in concentration camps. Here, he explained, their labor was to be utilized. I don't know if you're aware of this, dead people can't work in slave factories, in industrial factories. Only live people can do the work of an industrial complex. Only live people. So you can have your Jew or shoot him, but you can't shoot him and have him as an industrial worker. You can force your Jew to work for you, or you can shoot him, but you can't have both. All this is supposed to be deeply sinister and pregnant with the hidden meaning that the Jews were to be exterminated, though Professor Paul Racinier, or Racinier, I'm not sure how they pronounce that, a Frenchman, interned at Buchenwald, who has done sterling work in refuting the myth of the 6 million, explains that it means precisely what it says, i.e. the concentration of the Jews for labor in the immense eastern ghetto of the Polish government general. Remember, that's where most of the Jews were, was in Poland originally. Quote, there they were to wait until the end of the war for the reopening of international discussions, which would decide their future. This decision was finally reached at the Interministerial Berlin-Wannsee Conference. That's from Racinier, Le Véritable Prozess Eichmann, page 20. Manvel and Frankel, however, remain undaunted by the complete lack of reference to extermination. At the Wannsee Conference, they write, quote, direct references to killing were avoided, Heydrich favoring the term Arbeitseinsatz im Osten, work insertion in the East, or labor assignment in the East. Heinrich Himmler, page 209. Why we should not accept labor assignment in the East to mean labor assignment in the East is not explained. According to Reitlinger and others, innumerable directives actually specifying extermination then passed between Himmler, Heydrich Eichmann, and Commandant Hirsch in the subsequent months of 1942, but of course none have survived. Rather like the golden plates that the Book of Mormon was written off of. And those, as I happen to be reading this in late 2017, you will notice the similarity between this and the witch hunt proving collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign to get Trump elected American president. It's nothing but utter garbage, Jewish paranoia combined with Jewish big lying, amounting to a blood libel against white people. All this stuff is nothing but pure Jewish invention, pure Jewish lying. Twisted words and groundless assumptions. The complete lack of documentary evidence to support the existence of an extermination plan has led to the habit of reinterpreting the documents that do survive. Work with what you got, just twist it, torture the text until it screams what you want it to say. For example, it is held that a document concerning deportation is not about deportation at all, but a cunning way of talking about extermination. Manvel and Frankel state that, quote, various terms were used to camouflage genocide. These included Aussiedlung, desettlement, and Abeförderung, removal, Ibid, page 265. Thus, as we have seen already, words are no longer assumed to mean what they say if they prove too inconvenient to the big lie the Jews are trying to perpetrate. This kind of thing has taken to the most incredible extremes, such as their interpretation of Heydrich's directive for labor assignment in the East. Another example is a reference to Himmler's order for sending deportees to the East, quote, that is, having them killed, Ibid, page 251. Reitlinger, equally at a loss for evidence, does exactly the same, declaring that from the, quote, circumlocutionary words of the Wannsee Conference, it is obvious that the slow murder of an entire race was intended, unquote, Ibid, page 98. A review of the documentary situation is important because it reveals the edifice of guesswork and baseless assumptions upon which the extermination legend is built. The Germans had an extraordinary propensity for recording everything on paper in the most careful detail in this pre-computer age, yet among the thousands of captured documents of the SD and Gestapo, the records of the Reich Security Head Office, the files of Himmler's headquarters, and Hitler's own war directives, there is not a single order for the extermination of Jews or anyone else. It will be seen later that this has, in fact, been admitted by the World Center of Contemporary Jewish Documentation at Tel Aviv. Attempts to find, quote, veiled allusions to genocide in speeches like that of Himmler's to his SS Obergruppenführers at Posen in 1943 are likewise quite hopeless. Nuremberg statements extracted after the war, invariably under duress, are examined in the following chapter. So that finishes 4, and this is 5. The Nuremberg trials. The story of the 6 million was given judicial authority at the Nuremberg trials of German leaders between 1945 and 1949, proceedings which proved to be the most disgraceful legal farce in history. The Nuremberg trials were the most disgraceful legal farce in history. For a far more detailed study of the iniquities of these trials, which, as Field Marshal Montgomery said, made it a crime to lose a war, the reader is referred to the work cited below, and particularly to the outstanding book Advance to Barbarism, Nelson, 1953, by the distinguished English jurist F. J. P. Veal, V-E-A-L-E, Advance to Barbarism, 1953. From the very outset, the Nuremberg trials proceeded on the basis of gross statistical errors. In his speech of indictment on November 20, 1945, Mr. Sidney Alderman declared that there had been 9,600,000 Jews living in German-occupied Europe. Our earlier study has shown this figure to be wildly inaccurate. It is arrived at, A, by completely ignoring all Jewish emigration between 1933 and 1945, and B, by adding all the Jews of Russia, including the 2 million or more who were never in German-occupied territory. The same inflated figure, slightly enlarged to 9,800,000, was produced again at the Eichmann trial in Israel by Professor Shalom Baron. The alleged 6 million victims first appeared as the foundation for the prosecution at Nuremberg, and after some dalliance with 10 million or more by the press at the time, it eventually gained international popularity and acceptance. It is very significant, however, that although this outlandish figure was able to win credence in the reckless atmosphere of recrimination in 1945, it had become no longer tenable by 1961 at the Eichmann trial. The Jerusalem court studiously avoided mentioning the figure of 6 million, and the charge drawn up by Mr. Gideon Hausner simply said, quote, some, unquote, millions. So they said at the Eichmann trial, some millions, not six, some. And of course, even that is untrue. Legal principles ignored. Should anyone be misled into believing that the extermination of the Jews was, quote, proved at Nuremberg by, quote, evidence, he should consider the nature of the trials themselves, based as they were on a total disregard of sound legal principles of any kind. The accusers acted as prosecutors, judges, and executioners. Quote, guilt was assumed from the outset. Among the judges, of course, were the Russians, whose numberless crimes included the massacre of 15,000 Polish officers, a proportion of whose bodies were discovered by the Germans at Katyn Forest near Smolensk. The Soviet prosecutor attempted to blame this slaughter on the German defendants. The Soviet prosecutor at Nuremberg. At Nuremberg, ex post facto legislation was created, whereby men were tried for, quote, crimes, which were only declared crimes after they had been allegedly committed. They did stuff there was no law against. That's what ex post facto means. Hitherto, retroactively convicting someone under a law that did not exist when they performed whatever the behavior was. Hitherto, it had been the most basic legal principle that a person could only be convicted for infringing a law that was in force at the time of the infringement. Nulla pona sine lege. I guess that means no crime without a law, more or less. The rules of evidence developed by British jurisprudence over the centuries in order to arrive at the truth of a charge with as much certainty as possible, were entirely disregarded at Nuremberg. It was decreed that the tribunal, quote, that, pardon me, it was decreed that, quote, the tribunal should not be bound by technical rules of evidence, unquote, but could admit, quote, any evidence which it deemed to have probative value, unquote, that is, would support a conviction. In practice, this meant the admittance of hearsay evidence and documents, which in a normal judicial trial are always rejected as untrustworthy. That such evidence was allowed is of profound significance because it was one of the principal methods by which the extermination legend was fabricated through fraudulent written affidavits, quote-unquote, around written affidavits. Although only 240 witnesses were called in the course of the trials, no less than 300,000 of these, quote, written affidavits, unquote, were accepted by the court as supporting the charges without this evidence being heard under oath. Under these circumstances, any Jewish deportee or camp inmate could make any revengeful allegation that he pleased and not have to stand behind it. Most incredible of all, perhaps, was the fact that defense lawyers at Nuremberg were not permitted to cross-examine prosecution witnesses. A somewhat similar situation prevailed at the trial of Adolf Eichmann when it was announced that Eichmann's defense lawyer could be canceled at any time, quote, if an intolerable situation could arise or should arise. Which presumably meant that if his lawyer started to prove his innocence, you're doing a little too good there. We may have to haul you in. We may have to replace you. The real background of the Nuremberg trials was exposed by the American judge, Justice Wennerstrom, president of one of the tribunals. He was so disgusted by the proceedings that he resigned his appointment and flew home to America, leaving behind a statement to the Chicago Tribune, which enumerated, point by point, his objections to the trials. Cf. Mark Lautern, Das letzte Wort über Nuremberg, The Last Word About Nuremberg, page 56. Points 3 to 8 are as follows. 3. The members of the Department of the Public Prosecutor, instead of trying to formulate and reach a new guiding legal principle, were moved only by personal ambition and revenge. 4. The prosecution did its utmost, in every way possible, to prevent the defense preparing its case and to make it impossible for it to furnish evidence. 5. The prosecution, led by General Taylor, did everything in its power to prevent the unanimous decision of the military court being carried out, i.e. to ask Washington to furnish and make available to the court further documentary evidence in the possession of the American government. 6. 90% of the Nuremberg court consisted of biased persons who, either on political or racial grounds, furthered the prosecution's case. 7. The prosecution obviously knew how to fill all the administrative posts of the military court with, quote, Americans, quote unquote, whose naturalization certificates were very new indeed, and who, whether in the administrative service or by their translations, etc., created an atmosphere hostile to the accused persons. 8. The real aim of the Nuremberg trials was to show the Germans the crimes of their Führer, and this aim was at the same time the pretext on which the trials were ordered. Had I known several months earlier what was happening at Nuremberg, I would never have gone there. Concerning point 6, that 90% of the Nuremberg court consisted of people biased on racial or political grounds, this was a fact confirmed by others present. According to Earl Carroll, an American lawyer, 60% of the staff of the public prosecutor's office were German Jews who had left Germany after the promulgation of Hitler's race laws. He observed that not even 10% of the Americans employed at the Nuremberg courts were actually Americans by birth. So there are all these Jews masquerading as Americans to get revenge on the Germans for things they didn't even do that are simply concocted out of whole cloth. The chief of the public prosecutor's office, who worked behind General Taylor, was Robert M. Kempner, a German-Jewish emigrant. He was assisted by Morris Amchan. Mark Lautern, who observed the trials, writes in his book, quote, "They have all arrived, the Solomons, the Schlossbergers, and the Rabinoviches, members of the public prosecutor's staff." Ibid, page 68. It is obvious from these facts that the fundamental legal principle, that no man can sit in judgment on his own case, was abandoned altogether. Moreover, the majority of witnesses were also Jews. According to Professor Morris Bardesch, B-A-R-D-E-C-H-E, who was also an observer at the trials, the only concern of these witnesses was not to show their hatred too openly and to try and give an impression of objectivity. is from Nuremberg, Où la Terre Promise, Paris, 1948, page 149. Confessions under torture, confessions in parentheses, are in the tweezers. Confessions under torture. Altogether more disturbing, however, were the methods employed to extract statements and, quote, confessions at Nuremberg, particularly those from SS officers, which were used to support the extermination charge. The American Senator Joseph McCarthy, in a statement given to the American press on May 20, 1949, drew attention to the following cases of torture to secure such confessions. In the prison of the Schwäbisch Hall, he stated, officers of the SS Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler were flogged until they were soaked in blood, after which their sexual organs were trampled on as they lay prostrate on the ground. As in the notorious Malmedy trials of private soldiers, the prisoners were hoisted in the air and beaten until they signed the confessions demanded of them. On the basis of such confessions, extorted from SS generals Sepp Dietrich and Joachim Pieper, the Leibstandarte was convicted as a, quote, guilty organization. SS General Oswald Pohl, the economic administrator of the concentration camp system, had his face smeared with feces and was subsequently beaten until he supplied his confession. In dealing with these cases, Senator McCarthy told the press, quote, I have heard evidence and read documentary proofs to the effect that the accused persons were beaten up, maltreated, and physically tortured by methods which could only be conceived in sick brains. They were subjected to mock trials and pretended executions. They were told their families would be deprived of their ration cards. All these things were carried out with the approval of the public prosecutor in order to secure the psychological atmosphere necessary for the extortion of the required confessions. If the United States lets such acts committed by a few people go unpunished, then the whole world can rightly criticize us severely and forever doubt the correctness of our motives and our moral integrity. So there's another reason that the Jews hate McCarthy, is that he told the truth about what they did at Nuremberg, as well as telling the truth about the communist infiltration of the U.S. government, which is basically it's all just Jews. He didn't even go far enough. The methods of intimidation described were repeated during trials at Frankfurt am Main and at Dachau, and large numbers of Germans were convicted for atrocities on the basis of their admissions. The American judge Edward L. Van Roden, one of the three members of the Simpson Army Commission, which was subsequently appointed to investigate the methods of justice at the Dachau trials, revealed the methods by which these admissions were secured in the Washington Daily News, January 9, 1949. His account also appeared in the British newspaper, The Sunday Pictorial, January 23, 1949. The methods he described were, quote, posturing as priests to hear confessions and give absolution, torture with burning matches driven under the prisoner's fingernails, knocking out of teeth and breaking jaws, solitary confinement and near starvation rations. That's all a direct quote. Van Roden explained, quote, the statements which were admitted as evidence were obtained from men who had first been kept in solitary confinement for 3, 4, and 5 months. The investigators would put a black hood over the accused's head and then punch him in the face with brass knuckles, kick him, and beat him with rubber hoses. All but two of the Germans in the 139 cases we investigated had been kicked in the testicles beyond repair. This was standard operating procedure with our American investigators. Again, direct quote. The, quote, American investigators responsible, and who later functioned as the prosecution in the trials, were Lieutenant Colonel Burton F. Ellis, Chief of the War Crimes Committee, and his assistants, Captain Raphael Schumacher, Lieutenant Robert E. Byrne, Lieutenant William R. Pearl, Mr. Morris Elowitz, Mr. Harry Thon, and Mr. Kirschbaum. The legal advisor of the court was Colonel A. H. Rosenfeld. The reader will immediately appreciate from their names that the majority of these people were, quote, biased on racial grounds, unquote, in the words of Justice Wennerstrom, W-E-N-E-R-S-T-U-R-M. That is, were Jewish, and therefore should never have been involved in any such investigation. Despite the fact that confessions, quote-unquote, pertaining to the extermination of the Jews were extracted under these conditions, Nuremberg statements are still regarded as conclusive evidence for the 6 million by writers like Reitlinger and others, and the illusion is maintained that the trials were both impartial and impeccably fair. When General Taylor, the chief public prosecutor, was asked where he had obtained the figure of the 6 million, he replied that it was based on the confession of SS General Otto Ohlendorf. He too was tortured, and his case is examined below. But as far as such confessions in general are concerned, we can do no better than quote the British Sunday Pictorial when reviewing the report of Judge Van Roden. Quote, strong men were reduced to broken wrecks, ready to mumble any admission demanded by their prosecutors. So the so-called evidence was either produced from the Jews in the form of affidavits where there was absolutely no standard, no cross-examination allowed, and they got it from the Germans themselves by torturing them, all of them. So Nuremberg is inherently corrupt. It should be thrown out. The way it was conducted was not legal, was not fair, was not rational. It was purely revenge on the part of Jews who concealed it and used the garbage they generated by illegal means to perpetrate a malicious giant lie. Big lie is not even big enough. It's a giant lie. The Wislicene statement. Now, I'm not sure how this is pronounced. It looks Czech. Wislicene. Okay, I'm looking it up. I believe it's pronounced Wislicene. Wislicene. So more or less as it appears, Wislicene. The Wislicene statement. At this point, let us turn to some of the Nuremberg documents themselves. The document quoted most frequently in support of the legend of the 6 million, and which figures largely in Poliakov and Wolff's Das Dritte Reich und Juden, Dokumente und Aufsätze, is the statement of SS Captain Dieter Wislicene, an assistant in Adolf Eichmann's office and later the Gestapo chief in Slovakia. It was obtained under conditions even more extreme than those described above, for Wislicene fell into the hands of Czech communists and was, quote, interrogated, unquote, at the Soviet-controlled Bratislava prison in November 1946. Subjected to torture, Wislicene was reduced to a nervous wreck and became addicted to uncontrollable fits of sobbing for hours on end prior to his execution. Although the conditions under which his statement was obtained empty it entirely of all plausibility, Poliakov prefers to ignore this and merely writes, quote, in prison, he wrote several memoirs that contain information of great interest. Harvest of Hate, page 3. These memoirs include some genuine statements of fact to provide authenticity, such as that Himmler was an enthusiastic advocate of Jewish emigration, and that the emigration of Jews from Europe continued throughout the war, but in general they are typical of the communist-style, quote, confession produced at Soviet show trials. Frequent reference is made to exterminating Jews, and a flagrant attempt is made to implicate as many SS leaders as possible. Factual errors are also common, notably the statement that the war with Poland added more than 3 million Jews to the German-occupied territory, which we have disproved above. The case of the Einsatzgruppen. The Wislicene statement deals at some length with the activities of the Einsatzgruppen, or action groups, used in the Russian campaign. These must merit a detailed consideration in a survey of Nuremberg, because the picture presented of them at the trials represents a kind of, quote, 6 million in miniature, i.e. has been proved since to be the most enormous exaggeration and falsification. The Einsatzgruppen were four special units drawn from the Gestapo and the SD, SS Security Service, Sicherheitsdienst Security Service, whose task was to wipe out partisans and communist commissars in the wake of the advancing German armies in Russia. As early as 1939, there had been 34,000 of these political commissars attached to the Red Army. The activities of the Einsatzgruppen were the particular concern of the Soviet prosecutor Rudenko at the Nuremberg trials. The 1947 indictment of the four groups alleged that in the course of their operations, they had killed not less than 1 million Jews in Russia merely because they were Jews. These allegations have since been elaborated. It is now claimed that the murder of Soviet Jews by the Einsatzgruppen constituted phase one in the plan to exterminate the Jews, phase two being the transportation of European Jews to Poland. Reitlinger admits that the original term, quote, final solution, unquote, referred to emigration and had nothing to do with the liquidation of Jews, but he then claims that an extermination policy began at the time of the invasion of Russia in 1941. He considers Hitler's orders of July 1941 for the liquidation of the communist commissars, and he concludes that this was accompanied by a verbal order from Hitler for the Einsatzgruppen to liquidate all Soviet Jews. Die Endlösung, page 91. If this assumption is based on anything at all, it is probably the worthless Wislicy statement, which alleges that the Einsatzgruppen were soon receiving orders to extend their task of crushing communists and partisans to a, quote, general massacre of Russian Jews. So the Jews here are trying to turn anti-partisan activity into extermination. Another way to perpetrate the lie. It is very significant that, once again, it is a, quote, verbal order for exterminating Jews that is supposed to have accompanied Hitler's genuine written order, yet another nebulous and unprovable assumption on the part of Reitlinger. An earlier order from Hitler, dated March 1941 and signed by Field Marshal Keitel, makes it quite clear what the real tasks of the future Einsatzgruppen would be. It states that in the Russian campaign, the Reichsfuhrer SS, or Himmler, is to be entrusted with, quote, tasks for the political administration, tasks which result from the struggle which has to be carried out between two opposing political systems. Manvel and Frankel, Ibid, page 115. This plainly refers to eliminating communism, especially the political commissars whose specific task was communist indoctrination, that they'd be attached to the army units and be the ones keeping them politically correct, explaining the political nature of the work and enforcing the political rules of the communists. And so the Einsatzgruppen would be tasked, after territory was captured, with destroying any partisans that arose and also cleaning the communism out of the population, I guess. The Ohlendorf trial. The most revealing trial in the Einsatzgruppen case, quote-unquote, at Nuremberg, was that of SS General Otto Ohlendorf, the chief of the SD, who commanded Einsatzgruppe D in the Ukraine, attached to Field Marshal von Manstein's 11th Army. During the last phase of the war, he was employed as a foreign trade expert in the Ministry of Economics. Ohlendorf was one of those subjected to the torture described earlier, and in his affidavit of November 5, 1945, he was, quote, persuaded, unquote, to confess that 90,000 Jews had been killed under his command alone. Ohlendorf did not come to trial until 1948, long after the main Nuremberg trial, and by that time he was insisting that his earlier statement had been extracted from him under torture. In his main speech before the tribunal, Ohlendorf took the opportunity to denounce Philipp Auerbach, the Jewish attorney general of the Bavarian State Office for Restitution, who at that time was claiming compensation for, quote, 11 million Jews, unquote, who had suffered in German concentration camps. Ohlendorf dismissed this ridiculous claim, stating that, quote, not the minutest part, unquote, of the people for whom Auerbach was demanding compensation had even seen a concentration camp. Ohlendorf lived long enough to see Auerbach convicted for embezzlement and fraud, forging documents purporting to show huge payments of compensation to non-existent people, before his own execution finally took place in 1951. Ohlendorf explained to the tribunal that his units often had to prevent massacres of Jews organized by anti-Semitic Ukrainians behind the German front, and he denied that the Einsatzgruppen as a whole had inflicted even one quarter of the casualties, claimed by the prosecution. He insisted that the illegal partisan warfare in Russia, which he had to combat, had taken a far higher toll of lives from the regular German army, an assertion confirmed by the Soviet government, which boasted of 500,000 German troops killed by partisans. In fact, Franz Stahlecker, commander of Einsatzgruppe A in the Baltic region and White Russia, was himself killed by partisans in 1942. The English jurist F.J.P. Veal, in dealing with the action groups, explains that in the fighting on the Russian front, no distinction could be properly drawn between partisans and civilian population, because any Russian civilian who maintained his civilian status, instead of acting as a terrorist, was liable to be executed by his countrymen as a traitor. Veal says of the action groups, quote, "There is no question that their orders were to combat terror by terror," close quote, and he finds it strange that atrocities committed by the partisans in the struggle were regarded as blameless simply because they turned out to be on the winning side. Ibid, page 223. Ohlendorf took the same view, and in a bitter appeal written before his execution, he accused the Allies of hypocrisy in holding the Germans to account by conventional laws of warfare while fighting a savage Soviet enemy who did not respect those laws. Action Group Executions Distorted. The Soviet charge that the action groups had wantonly exterminated 1 million Jews during their operations has been shown subsequently to be a massive falsification. In fact, there had never been the slightest statistical basis for the figure. In this connection, Polyakov and Wolf cite the statement of Wilhelm Hödl, the dubious American spy, double agent, and former assistant of Eichmann. Hödl, it will be remembered, claimed that Eichmann had, quote, told him, unquote, that 6 million Jews had been exterminated, and he added that 2 million of these had been killed by the Einsatzgruppen, the action groups. This absurd figure went beyond even the wildest estimates of Soviet prosecutor Rudenko, and it was not given any credence by the American tribunal which tried and condemned Ohlendorf. The real number of casualties for which the action groups were responsible has since been revealed in the scholarly work of Manstein, his campaigns and his trial. London, 1951, that's a book, Manstein, His Campaigns and His Trial, by the able English lawyer R.T. Paget, P-A-G-E-T. Ohlendorf had been under Manstein's nominal command. Paget's conclusion is that the Nuremberg court, in accepting the figure of the Soviet prosecution, exaggerated the number of casualties by more than 1,000%, and that they distorted even more the situations in which these casualties were inflicted. So they're lying about the numbers killed, and they're lying about the conditions that were going on. They're saying the Germans rounded up and killed these people. They're saying, no, it was a brutal, dirty partisan war, and the Soviets initiated these tactics and killed far more Germans than the Germans killed of them and their commissars. These horrific distortions are the subject of 6 pages of William Shirer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, pages 1140 to 46, Here, then, is the legendary 6 million in miniature, not 1 million deaths, but 100,000. Of course, only a small proportion of these could have been Jewish partisans and communist functionaries. It is worth repeating that these casualties were inflicted during savage partisan warfare on the Eastern Front, and that Soviet terrorists claimed to have killed 5 times that number of German troops. So the Germans probably killed 100,000, but the Soviets killed 500,000 and bragged about it. It has nevertheless remained a popular myth that the extermination of the Jews began with the actions of the Einsatzgruppen in Russia. In conclusion, we may briefly survey the Manstein trial itself, typical in so many ways of Nuremberg proceedings. Principally because Action Group D was attached to Manstein's command, though it was responsible solely to Himmler, the 62-year-old invalid field marshal, considered by most authorities to be the most brilliant German general of the war, was subjected to the shameful indignity of a, quote, war crimes, unquote, trial. Of the 17 charges, 15 were brought by the communist Russian government and 2 by the communist Polish government. Only one witness was called to give evidence at this trial, and he proved so unsatisfactory that the prosecution withdrew his evidence. Reliance was placed instead on 800 hearsay documents, which were accepted by the court, without any proof of their authenticity or authorship. The prosecution introduced written affidavits by Ohlendorf and other SS leaders, but since these men were still alive, Manstein's defense lawyer, Reginald Paget, KC, demanded their appearance in the witness box. This was refused by the American authorities, and Paget declared that this refusal was due to fear lest the condemned men reveal what methods had been used to induce them to sign their affidavits. Manstein was eventually acquitted on 8 of the charges, including the 2 Polish ones, which, as Paget said, were, quote, so flagrantly bogus that one was left wondering why they had been presented at all, close quote. The Oswald Pohl trial, P-O-H-L. Oswald Pohl trial. The case of the action groups is a revealing insight into the methods of the Nuremberg trials and the fabrication of the myth of the 6 million. Another is the trial of Oswald Pohl in 1948, which is of great importance as it bears directly on the administration of the concentration camp system. Pohl had been the chief dispersing officer of the German Navy until 1934, when Himmler requested his transfer to the SS. For 11 years, he was the principal administrative chief of the entire SS in his position as the head of the SS Economy and Administration Office, which after 1941 was concerned with the industrial productivity of the concentration camp system. A peak point of hypocrisy was reached at the trial when the prosecution said to Pohl that, quote, had Germany rested content with the exclusion of Jews from her own territory, with denying them German citizenship, with excluding them from public office, or any like domestic regulation, no other nation could have been heard to complain, close quote. The truth is that Germany was bombarded with insults and economic sanctions for doing precisely these things, and her internal measures against the Jews were certainly a major cause of the declaration of war against Germany by the democracies. Oswald Pohl was an extremely sensitive and intellectual individual who was reduced to a broken man in the course of his trial. As Senator McCarthy pointed out, Pohl had signed some incriminating statements after being subjected to severe torture, including a bogus admission that he had seen a gas chamber at Auschwitz in the summer of 1944. The prosecution strenuously pressed this charge, but Pohl successfully repudiated it. The aim of the prosecution was to depict this dejected man as a veritable fiend in human shape, an impression hopelessly at variance with the testimony of those who knew him. Such testimony was given by Heinrich Höpker, an anti-Nazi friend of Pohl's wife who came into frequent contact with him during the period 1942-45. Höpker noted that Pohl was essentially a serene and mild-mannered person. H-O-E-P-K-E-R. During a visit to Pohl in the spring of 1944, Höpker was brought into contact with concentration camp inmates who were working on a local project outside the camp area. He noted that the prisoners worked in a leisurely manner in a relaxed atmosphere without any pressure from their guards. Höpker declared that Pohl did not hold an emotional attitude to the Jews and did not object to his wife entertaining her Jewish friend, Anna Marie Jacques, at their home. By the beginning of 1945, Höpker was fully convinced that the administrator of the concentration camps was a humane, conscientious, and dedicated servant of his task, and he was astonished when he heard later in 1945 of the accusations being made against Pohl and his colleagues. Frau Pohl noted that her husband retained his serenity in the face of adversity until March 1945, when he visited the camp at Bergen-Belsen at the time of the typhus epidemic there. Hitherto, the camp had been a model of cleanliness and order, but the chaotic conditions at the close of the war had reduced it to a state of extreme hardship. Pohl, who was unable to alleviate conditions there because of the desperate pass which the war had reached by that time, was deeply affected by the experience and, according to his wife, never regained his former state of composure. Dr. Alfred Seidel, the highly respected lawyer who acted as a principal defense counsel at the Nuremberg trials, went to work passionately to secure the acquittal of Pohl. Seidel had been a personal friend of the accused for many years and was thoroughly convinced of his innocence with respect to the fraudulent charge of planned genocide against the Jews. The Allied judgment which condemned Pohl did not prompt Seidel to change his opinion in the slightest. He declared that the prosecution had failed to produce a single valid piece of evidence against him. One of the most eloquent defenses of Oswald Pohl was made by SS Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Schmidt Klevenow, K-L-E-V-E-N-O-W, a legal officer in the SS Economy and Administration Office, in his affidavit of August 8, 1947. This affidavit has been deliberately omitted from the published documents known as the Trials of the War Criminals before the Nuremberg Military Tribunals, 1946 to 1949. Schmidt Klevenow pointed out that Pohl had given his fullest support to Judge Conrad Morgan of the Reich Criminal Police Office, whose job was to investigate irregularities at the concentration camps. Later on, we shall refer to a case in which Pohl was in favor of the death penalty for Camp Commandant Koch, who was accused by an SS court of misconduct. Schmidt Klevenow explained that Pohl was instrumental in arranging for local police chiefs to share in the jurisdiction of concentration camps and took personal initiative in securing strict discipline on the part of camp personnel. In short, the evidence given at the Pohl trial shows that the proceedings involved nothing less than the deliberate defamation of a man's character in order to support the propaganda legend of genocide against the Jews in the concentration camps he administered. Falsified evidence and fraudulent affidavits. Spurious testimony at Nuremberg, which included extravagant statements in support of the myth of the 6 million, was invariably given by former German officers because of pressure, either severe torture, as in the cases cited previously, or the assurance of leniency for themselves if they supplied the required statements. An example of the latter was the testimony of SS General Erich von dem Bock-Zelewski. He was threatened with execution himself because of his suppression of the revolt by Polish partisans at Warsaw in August 1944, which he carried out with his SS Brigade of White Russians. He was therefore prepared to be, quote, cooperative. The evidence of Bock-Zelewski, a hyphenated name, constituted the basis of the testimony against the Reichsfuhrer of the SS, Heinrich Himmler, at the main Nuremberg trial, Trial of the Major War Criminals, Volume 4, page 29 and 36. In March 1941, on the eve of the invasion of Russia, Himmler invited the higher SS leaders to his castle at Wewelsburg for a conference, including Bock-Zelewski, who was an expert on partisan warfare. In his Nuremberg evidence, he depicted Himmler speaking in grandiose terms at this conference about the liquidation of peoples in Eastern Europe. But Göring, in the courtroom, denounced Bock-Zelewski to his face for the falsity of this testimony. An especially outrageous allegation concerned a supposed declaration by Himmler that one of the aims of the Russian campaign was to, quote, decimate the Slav population by 30 millions. What Himmler really said is, given by his chief of staff, Wolf, that war in Russia was certain to result in millions of dead. Manville and Frankel, Ibid, page 117. Another brazen falsehood was Bock-Zelewski's accusation that on August 31, 1942, Himmler personally witnessed the execution of 100 Jews by an Einsatz detachment at Minsk, causing him to nearly faint. It is known, however, that on this date Himmler was in conference at his field headquarters at Zhytomyr in the Ukraine, cf. K. Vowinkel, Die Wehrmacht im Kampf, The Wehrmacht in Struggle and Fight in War, Volume 4, page 275. Much is made of Bock-Zelewski's evidence in all the books on Himmler, especially Willy Frischauer's Himmler, Evil Genius of the Third Reich, from London, 1953, page 148. However, in April 1959, Bock-Zelewski publicly repudiated his Nuremberg testimony before a West German court, He admitted that his earlier statements had not the slightest foundation, in fact, and that he had made them for the sake of expediency and his own survival. The German court, after careful deliberation, accepted his retraction. Needless to say, what Veel calls the, quote, iron curtain of discreet silence descended immediately over these events. They have had no influence whatever on the books which propagate the myth of the 6 million, and Bach-Zelewski's testimony on Himmler is still taken at its face value. The truth concerning Himmler is provided ironically by an anti-Nazi, Felix Kersten, K-E-R-S-T-E-N, his physician and masseur. Because Kersten was opposed to the regime, he tends to support the legend that the internment of Jews meant their extermination. But, from his close personal knowledge of Himmler, he cannot but help but tell the truth concerning him, and in his memoirs, 1940 to 1945, London 1956, page 119 FF, he is emphatic in stating that Heinrich Himmler did not advocate liquidating the Jews, but favored their emigration overseas. Felix Kersten, the personal physician to Himmler, says, and an anti-Nazi, said that Himmler did not advocate liquidating Jews, but sending them overseas. Neither does Kersten implicate Hitler. However, the credibility of his anti-Nazi narrative is completely shattered when, in search of an alternative villain, he declares that Dr. Goebbels was the real advocate of, quote, extermination. This nonsensical allegation is amply disproved by the fact that Goebbels was still concerned with the Madagascar project even after it had been temporarily shelved by the German Foreign Office, as we showed earlier. So much for false evidence at Nuremberg. Reference has also been made to the thousands of fraudulent, quote, written affidavits, unquote, which were accepted by the Nuremberg court without any attempt to ascertain the authenticity of their contents or even their authorship. These hearsay documents, often of the most bizarre kind, were introduced as evidence so long as they bore the required signature. A typical prosecution affidavit contested by the defense in the concentration camp trial of 1947 was that of Alois Hohlriegel, a member of the camp personnel at Mauthausen in Austria, H-O-E-L-L-R-I-E-G-E-L. This affidavit, which the defense proved was fabricated during Hohlriegel's torture, had already been used to secure the conviction of SS General Ernst Kaltenbrunner in 1946. It claimed that a mass gassing operation had taken place at Mauthausen and that Hohlriegel had witnessed Kaltenbrunner, the highest SS leader in the Reich, excepting Himmler, actually taking part in it. So Hohlriegel says that Kaltenbrunner was part of a mass gassing. By the time of the concentration camp trial, Pohl's trial, a year later, it had become impossible to sustain this piece of nonsense when it was produced in court again. The defense not only demonstrated that the affidavit was falsified, but showed that all deaths at Mauthausen were systematically checked by the local police authorities. They were also entered on a camp register, and particular embarrassment was caused to the prosecution when the Mauthausen register, one of the few that survived, was produced in evidence. The defense also obtained numerous affidavits from former inmates of Mauthausen, a prison camp chiefly for criminals, testifying to humane and orderly conditions there. Allied accusations disbelieved. There is no more eloquent testimony to the tragedy and tyranny of Nuremberg than the pathetic astonishment or outraged disbelief of the accused persons themselves at the grotesque charges made against them. Such is reflected in the affidavit of SS Major General Heinz Fanslau, F-A-N-S-L-A-U, who visited most of the German concentration camps during the last years of the war. Although a frontline soldier of the Waffen-SS, Fanslau had taken a great interest in concentration camp conditions, and he was selected as a prime target by the Allies for the charge of conspiracy to annihilate the Jews. It was argued on the basis of his many contacts that he must have been fully involved. When it was first rumored that he would be tried and convicted, hundreds of affidavits were produced on his behalf by camp inmates he had visited. When he read the full scope of the indictments against the concentration camp personnel in Supplementary Nuremberg Trial No. 4 on May 6, 1947, Fanslau declared in disbelief, quote, "This cannot be possible because I, too, would have had to know something about it," close quote. It should be emphasized that throughout the Nuremberg proceedings, the German leaders on trial never believed for a moment the allegations of the Allied prosecution. Hermann Göring, who was exposed to the full brunt of the Nuremberg atrocity propaganda, failed to be convinced by it. Hans Fritzsche, on trial as the highest functionary of Goebbels' ministry, relates that Göring, even after hearing the Ohlendorf affidavit on the Einsatzgruppen and the Höss testimony on Auschwitz, remained convinced that the extermination of Jews was entirely propaganda fiction. It's from The Sword in the Scales, London, 1953, page 145. The Sword in the Scales. At one point during the trial, Göring declared rather cogently that the first time he had heard of it was, quote, right here in Nuremberg. This plan to exterminate the Jews. And that's a cite from Scheirer, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, Ibid, page 1147. The Jewish writers Polyakov, Reitlinger, and Manvel and Frankel all attempt to implicate Göring in this supposed extermination, but Charles Bewley, B-E-W-L-E-Y, in his work Hermann Göring, 1956, Charles Bewley, shows that not the slightest evidence was found at Nuremberg to substantiate this charge. Hans Fritzsche pondered on the whole question during the trials, and he concluded that there had certainly been no thorough investigation of these monstrous charges. Fritzsche, who was acquitted, was an associate of Goebbels and a skilled propagandist. He recognized that the alleged massacre of the Jews was the main point of the indictment against all defendants. So Goebbels' guy Fritzsche sees, okay, so their big thing here is they're trying to prove that we had a plan to exterminate the Jews. Kaltenbrunner, who succeeded Heydrich as chief of the Reich Security Head Office and was the main defendant for the SS due to the death of Himmler, was no more convinced of the genocide charges than was Göring. He confided to Fritzsche that the prosecution was scoring apparent successes because of their technique of coercing witnesses and suppressing evidence, which was precisely the accusation of judges Wennerstrom and Van Roden. So the few Aryans involved are generally honest, and they see what's going on here, and they're sickened by it. And we'll close there for today. We've gone through 5 points, and there's another, I think, maybe 4 or 5 left to go. Thanks for being with me as we listen to the truth about Nuremberg, and we hear about and deconstruct the myth of the murdered 6 million. I'll be back with you again real soon.